Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
And I'm Jahat Ali.
And we are so happy to be joined by the author of, let me tell you something, a book that is right on time, Stephen Fish, who is a comparative political scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. And the book is Comeback, Rooting Trumpism, Reclaiming the Nation, and Restoring Democracy's Edge. And Waj, I will turn it over to you for your movie phone introduction.
Professor Stephen Fish specializes in democracy and authoritarianism, religion and politics, and constitutional systems and national legislatures. He is the author of multiple books and also the recipient of the Distinguished Social Sciences Teaching Award of the College of Letters and Science at UC Berkeley, my alma mater.
Thank you, Stephen, for tolerating that immaturity. But as I was telling you before, this is a very biased show, and I'm always biased towards people from the Bay Area and my alma mater of UC Berkeley. So it gives me great joy that you are the author of this book. And before we ask the first question, you, like me, are a proud husband. You have married way up. And so I want you to get husband equity. And I was looking on the cover of this book that it wasn't just M. Stephen Fish, it's with someone. So let's give a shout out to who you wrote this book with.
Well, I wrote this book with my wonderful wife. She's kind of the brains behind the operation. And there's a backstory in this, Waj. On the night that Trump was elected, as I recall, it was the night of the 8th and 9th November in 2016, I was stomping around my apartment in Albany, California, and ranting for hours and hours. And finally, at about 4 o'clock in the morning, I just collapsed on the couch, spent and dejected. And my wife came over to me and said, she's ever the optimist. And she said, you know, look, you've studied and tried to make a little bit of a difference around the world with all these countries you've studied to help, you know, in studying their democracies and how people got their freedom and how they can keep it. And did you ever think you'd have the privilege of actually doing that in your own country? Mm. And that was the call for me. That was the deal. And ever since that night, since Layla, my wife, issued that call, I decided that, you know, I got to do what I can. So I'm bringing, you know, what I know as a comparative political scientist who studied Russia and Indonesia and Poland and other countries kind of to bear on what's going on in the United States. I'm not a career-long specialist in the United States. But a lot of career-long specialists in the United States don't study these big questions like authoritarian challenges, you know, regime questions, because we've never had this problem in the United States before. We've never had, you know, we haven't had this kind of a threat to democracy.
Well, Danielle, I want to ask this question and give it to you because you start off the book with an interesting premise that the standard story that we've heard for the past years about democracy in decline, right? The crisis of democracy is not the real story. And anyone who listens to us, you know, this podcast is called Democracy-ish. We're like, we're hanging on to a thread here. And the polls, and I'm sure that you have seen around the world, democracy is backsliding. And we've seen a surge, or at least an embrace, a very scary embrace of right-wing authoritarianism. I would say fascism. So what is according to your analysis and research, the correct story that should replace what you say is the incorrect standard story about democracy in 2024?
Well, what I found to be the incorrect story, which I, you know, believed for the most part myself until I did the research, was the one that you know, most people believe. So why did we get Trump? The white working class found itself in kind of long-term decline. The minimum wage did not rise at all. In fact, it deteriorated in real terms. Working class frustration grew over recent decades. Income inequality skyrocketed. The poor white working man, felt more and more frustrated. So his bigotry grew, and that turned him to Trump. The fact is, as I looked around the world, there are so many analogous cases to your point, Waj, about this. This is not just an American phenomenon. We've also had the rise of these right-wing, what I call ethno-nationalists, around the world, from India to Poland, to Hungary, and many other cases as well. But what I noted when I looked at all these cases was that typically these authoritarian demagogues were not coming to power in places where there'd been economic crisis or where the middle class had been declining or where the working class was declining. On the contrary, if you look at India and Poland and many other cases, their economies have done great and the average guy's done great as well. And when I turned to the United States, I saw, if you look at the survey data going back to the 1970s, there has not been this big escalation in white working
economic
class
anxiety?
If anything,
what?
Yeah.
Economic anxiety. You know what? It's always been there, Waj. And the fact is, it's no worse now than it was going back to, you know, what a lot of people think of the kind of the golden age of middle class expansion, you know, from the 50s to the 1970s. And I thought, you know, maybe something else is at work here. And if you look at it all across all these different cases, and the United States seems to fit this too, what you see is liberals losing their nationalist mojo. They kind of forget about the importance of patriotism and tying their progressive causes, so their pro-democratic causes, to a kind of grand national story about, you know, our country showing the world what we're made of. And these authoritarian demagogues come along and they tell this story of national greatness. Another thing liberals have lost is their kind of dominance edge. And I talk a lot about this in the book, about high versus low dominance politics. They've gotten I wouldn't say just too nice, but they've lost track of the fact that politics is a dominance competition. And it's a competition to capture the flag. They've gotten squeamish about nationalism, squeamish about dominance. And as a result, it's left room for these, what I call these high dominance ethno-nationalists like Trump and Modi and Putin to come along and claim not just the kind of working class from the ethnic majority, but a lot of people outside that group as well. You know, we see in the United States now an awful lot of people of color turning to Trump. So the story that liberals are telling around the world about their countries no longer really connects with people. And working class people oftentimes don't recognize themselves in the story that liberals tell about them. I found that this, much more than kind of working class economic frustration, which hasn't risen that much, or rising bigotry, which is really kind of a myth. I mean, in our country in particular, it's been this really radical liberalization in terms of people's attitudes, including white working class attitudes on issues like race and immigration over the last 50 years or so. So my explanation is very different from what you get in the so-called standard story.
I love it. And I appreciate it so much because, like I said before we started recording, for so long, I have said that one of the many issues that I find with liberals and progressives, and I count myself as one of them, is this ceding that we have done to patriotism, that we have let go of the word patriotism, we've let go of the flag, and we have allowed the right to claim it. Right. You see pictures of Donald Trump hugging a flag. Right. You see pictures of them in their Old Navy American flag T-shirts and shorts on the 4th of July. And for me, I think that what we have lost is our American identity. We're fine with the critique of America, but we don't own Americanism as a part of our value statement. And I think that what your book does and what you offer in the critique is saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, why has this been ceded? And so I wonder, Because it also goes to the place of dominance, and it goes to this desire for a strong man to, you know, to come in and to fix all of the problems. And so, you know, when you lay out so many of the facts, when you debunk the economic, you know, the economic anxiety, and you kind of run through the way comparatively that the United States has continued to do better, has continued to flourish, even though we had Reaganomics that we still operate under. Talk to us about this idea of patriotism and the importance of the reclamation of that.
Okay, so imagine the following situation. You have a party that has turned away from America's most sacred tradition, which is our democracy. That's what our country was founded for. Now, it took us 200 years to democratize fully, obviously, and for African Americans to get the right to vote in the region in which they, you know, were more, where most of them lived, which is in the South. But this country has, you know, it started as a very imperfect, partial democracy, and then it became a full democracy over a couple of centuries. But we still basically, you know, are the inventor of modern democracy, the United States. Democracy is bred into our bones. That's our most sacred national tradition. Along the way, we've acquired other sacred traditions, like defending our democratic allies against our sworn enemies, whether they be fascism or Stalinism. And what's more, of course, we're a nation of immigrants. That's our kind of third, you know, I call it a pillar of Americanism, which is a relatively open immigration policy. It doesn't mean open borders and illegal immigration is great. What it means is that we are a nation of immigrants that honors immigrants and has relatively large quotas for immigrants from all over the world. Now, a party comes along that used to be down with most of those things, and all of a sudden, it becomes a cult figure to a single man, and it sells out all those principles, all of them. It sides with our greatest sworn enemies, like Vladimir Putin, for example, against our democratic allies. It becomes an anti-democratic party that thinks that somehow it has the right to hold itself in power using, you know, any means at its disposal, an insurrection, all manner of lies, the big lie that they actually won afterwards, that wants to turn away from our immigrant tradition and vilify even legal immigration, right? So, and this party is still regarded in public opinion polls as the more patriotic party. Now, how off our game do we progressives have to be for them to be able to seize the flag? And to your point, our job now, one of our main jobs is to seize the flag back from them. Whose country, and I tell my students this, including the ones who are very skeptical about patriotism, look, it's your, I mean, whose country do you want this to be? If you're going to give up the flag and give up on America and faith in America, and if you're not going to be proud of being an American or grateful to be an American, then MAGA wins. They win the flag. And I can tell you as a comparative political scientist, around the world in any country, the party and the politician that owns the flag has a huge leg up. This should be a piece of cake for us because the Republicans are betraying our country. But our squeamishness about nationalism has led us astray. The thing is, you don't have to look that far back in our history in order to find liberals who were very in-your-face nationalists and who tied their every progressive program to the flag. That middle third of the 20th century, when every progressive program that we are now fighting a rearguard action to defend went into effect, basically from FDR to Lyndon Johnson, was a time of democratic dominance. And they didn't just do it. FDR, Truman, JFK, Johnson didn't just do it by being compassionate progressives. They tethered their every program to this notion of American greatness and America showing the world what we're made of. And they got people excited about progressive programs. It wasn't just about, here's the material benefits I'm going to offer you. We can lower the prices of your Valium and your Viagra, right? So that doesn't thrill people. People want their progressive programs, including progressives, tied to this notion of national greatness. John Kennedy was a master at this, and nobody was better at it than Martin Luther King.
From the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel of a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about David's 18 months working for the senator's presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets a myriad of people who raise a set of questions. Questions of history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his own life anew and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man and father in America. Inspired by the author's experiences working on Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, Cunningham uses a political campaign as his narrative backbone. Great Expectations will be one of the talked-about novels of the year, Colm McCann. Great Expectations is available wherever books are sold.
A story, an identity, right? But also you need power in order to flex and implement that policy. And I am interested in the section of your book where you talk about to regain dominance, right? And perhaps because Shogun is in my mind right now because I just finished the miniseries, which is excellent. Spoiler alert for those who are listening. But in Shogun, the update, the remake, which is fantastic. It's on Hulu. People should see it. Lord Toranaga plays a long-term game for power. Right. And there's some great lines in the show where someone says, oh, how does it feel to control the fate of the wind? And he goes, I do not control the wind. I merely study it. And then throughout the series, people ask the characters, well, how are you going to get away with that? There's no way you can do that. And then both Toranaga and Blackthorn say, well, not unless I win. If I win, I can. And I feel like Republicans understand that if we win, we can do whatever we want. Who cares what the majority thinks? We have the Supreme Court.
Right.
Goodbye, abortion. You know, here comes Citizens United. Here comes dark money. Here's some Clarence Thomas who's openly, you know, bribed. What are you going to do about it? Here's Donald Trump openly crime. What are you going to do about it? I got the power. What are you going to do? And I feel like liberals in particular, you know, we bring a pencil to a knife fight, and Mitch McConnell brings like a grenade launcher. And so how can Democrats, Steve, not just regain power, but flex power for the sake of democracy?
Okay, that's a good point, because you get to power and you flex power basically the same way. And in part, you have a national story that is an inclusive national story and your own liberal brand of nationalism that beats their cramped, racialized, nativist, ethno-national tale. But to your point on dominance, which is really the kind of the second, you know, prong of our attack, if we're going to do this right. Look, the Republicans become masters of dominance politics. Democrats are squeamish with dominance, just like they become squeamish with nationalism. JFK and MLK and FDR were not squeamish about dominance, right? They knew they had to basically own the Republicans. They owned the illibs. Today, the illibs own the libs. That's a dominance game. So what's a high dominance politician? First of all, a high dominance politician or party tries to make opinion rather than just taking it. This is the essence of leadership, okay? So Trump, I hate to say it, is a leader in this respect. He's a high dominance politician. He tells you what he thinks and what he wants you to believe. The Democrats tell you what the polls tell them you believe, and then they tell you what they think you want to hear, right? Mm-hmm. People respect dominance, the quality of leadership in their leaders. They want leaders to tell them what those leaders think. People want to be persuaded. A colleague of mine, my next door neighbor here on campus, Gabriel Lenz, has written a wonderful book called Follow the Leader. And what he finds is people actually believe what their leaders tell them. Mm-hmm. And they mm-hmm. follow their leaders. People want to be led. They don't want to just be petitioned, right?
So, Steve, can I interrupt for 1 second and just give an example, which is topical, sure, because we're taping it right now? You know, Summer Lee in Pennsylvania yesterday just won. A whopping victory, right? And people were, you know, the Democratic establishment was saying, oh, there's no way. She's bucking the trend. She's bucking the polls. She stood by her principles. She energized her base. And she won by, I think, what was it, 15 percentage points, Danielle? Yep. I just want to throw that in there because it's so topical. But please continue. I didn't mean to derail your train of thought.
Oh, it's a great example. Watch it. I'm gonna follow that with another example. So look at the one Democratic governor in a southern state. and it's my home state. I'm a Kentucky boy, and it's Andy Beshear. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, Andy Beshear, you might think, since he's a Democrat in Kentucky, he must govern as kind of a conservative Democrat, right? He doesn't. You look at his economic policies, basically Bernie. He wades into the culture wars on his own terms. The first thing he did when he got to office, when he was elected at 41 years old, was reopen the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Louisville. He marches in pride parades. He proudly has his picture taken with drag queens in pride parades. During COVID, he issued these nightly, like, COVID shows where he went on, he chided the unvaccinated. He pushed through a masking mandate. This is all in Kentucky, right? None of these policies actually line up with public opinion very well. He vetoed an anti-abortion bill, right? And you would think, well, how does this man win in Kentucky? The fact is, he's a leader. People respect that. Mm-hmm. And he just beat a Mitch McConnell protege by 5 points for re-election, and his state Trump took by 26 points. People respect leadership. They would rather have somebody who really leads, who really has the courage of their convictions and tries to persuade them, than someone who just reads the polls and tells them what they think they want to believe. Unfortunately, this is what Hillary Clinton did, and this is how
I was literally just going to say that.
Absolutely. That was Trump's superpower, right? That he told everybody exactly what he thought. Hillary told you exactly what she thought you wanted to believe. So even on core issues like trade and same-sex marriage. So she's this big champion of NAFTA, right? She's the big free trade agreement of the early 1990s. Because, basically she was the brains behind the Clinton operation. And Clinton was a NAFTA guy. He was a free trader. Trans-Pacific Partnership, another free trade thing. Hillary was all down with these free trade policies, except on leap years when she was running for president. On same-sex marriage, she was almost comically against same-sex marriage. Everybody knew Hillary was fine with same-sex marriage until the very week when, like, her pollsters told her, okay, now it's okay to tip, and she tipped. Americans looked at that, and even though she was immensely better qualified, obviously, and even though she was intellectually more capable and all this other stuff, they still regarded Donald Trump, and the poll showed this, as more trustworthy than her. He lies about everything under the sun, but he tells you his own truth. He tells you what he believes. He doesn't tell you what he thinks you want to hear. And she always told you what she thought you wanted to believe.
What she thought you, and that's what I, and that's the point that I think that Democrats don't get. It isn't like, why is Trumpism so stirring? Like, why is it such, why is it an ideology that people are compelled and drawn to? And that's not it, right? They're compelled to people who, even when they're wrong, will say that they're right. And Democrats are like, let me research this first and I'll get back to you. And I think that, when I'm looking at a Hillary Clinton, a Barack Obama, and a Joe Biden that we have right now, the reason why I think that people loved Barack Obama so much is because he did tie our nationalism to this idea of, yes, we can. He did restore in us this feeling that, like, we are not the red states or the blue states, we are the United States, right? He did give us this feeling of, we can be better, right? Every generation's responsibility is to be better, do better, and think bolder than the last one. I don't think, Steve, that Biden, right, does that. Biden did not win, and you tell me, in 2020, because Biden somehow was able to kind of pick up the torch of Obama and instill in us some type of value about us as Americans.
Okay, so you have a ton of great points here, and let me just try to address each one. First of all, I do think that Obama really had a story. Now, Obama was the national story in some ways. He was kind of what I call a national democratic narrative. He just embodied it, right? And so he never really had to articulate a story in a kind of systematic way that, JFK or FDR or MLK did, because he just was the kind of, he was America at its best, and he embodied it himself. that was compelling enough for Democrats while he was in office, because he made democracy very cool again, and he made democracy cool in the world, and he made America cool in the world. The problem is that that didn't give Biden and other Democrats a lot to work with, right? Including Hillary Clinton, because they really couldn't be Obama. They had to develop their own national stories, and they haven't really done that in a really forceful way yet. To your first point about Trump, you're absolutely right. Trump's story is not compelling to most Americans. If you look at his whole kind of nativist, cramped, racialized, ethno-national story is appealing to a small and diminishing minority of people. The problem is the Democrats don't have their own counter-narrative. They don't really have a national story, right? And so in the absence of that, Trump's pathetic story is all Americans hear. Right. His story is basically the good, decent people of the heartland, you know, read white Christian people are being put upon and abused by people of color and immigrants and these liberal elites from the coast who are in, you know, in cahoots with them. That's his national story. OK, now, how hard should that be to be? Well, the Democrats, they don't have a national story. They're squeamish about nationalism. They've forgotten how to tether their progressive policies to a compelling national story in the way that someone like MLK did. And so it's the only story Americans get. So that's a huge problem. We need a national story. What's more, Trump tells it in this high dominance way. He convinces you that he really believes it, so you should believe it too.
Yep.
The Democrats are ever fretting about the country's, you know, problems and the complexities of all these awful problems we face, all of which are true. But, you know, you can be an MLK or a JFK and say, yes, we've got a raft of problems, but look at the progress we've made. Look at the incredible things we've accomplished. And, you know, with that kind of history behind us, we can do still greater things in the future. I've gone back and analyzed the speeches, starting with Frederick Douglass, who is a master of this kind of messaging, going through FDR, JFK, LBJ. What I found is there's a common thread in their addresses and their themes. They attack injustice, but they start off with this kind of problem. And then they tell you these glorious stories about past progress and all the incredible things we've done. And only then do they pause and say, ah, but the mountain is only half climbed. Here's the agenda now. Here's what we've still got to do. And then they would end with this like redemptive tale about America, like conquering everything. You know, America can do absolutely everything. Look at what we've done in the past. It was a much more effective way of getting people excited, people of all ethnicities and all classes excited about tackling injustice than just talking, you know, the way the Democrats these days do, just kind of fretting about all the problems we've got. That's not a compelling story to most people.
Well, Steve, what you were saying is what Biden does right now is he fast forwards to the end. If you listen to his speeches, he goes, America can do anything. America can conquer anything. We're Americans. We've gone to the moon. But he misses the first fundamental parts of the story, right? And what Obama followed was what Harvard professor Marshall Ganz gave a model. It's like, first you center the story in yourself. And then after you center the story of yourself, you connect it to the nation, a community, and then you do a call to action. So when Obama says change and hope, he says, look at me, a multiracial kid who's lived around the globe. And if I can make it, anyone can make it. This is the story of America, where a guy like me can make it. And people are like, damn right. Yes. Now change hope. Trump did bullshit, but he also did the same thing. Self-made man, wealth.
Right.
You know, power, grievance,
privilege.
Make America great again. I can make America great again because I made business great again. And people are like, that guy sold a bullshit story of being the, you know, the gilded kingmaker. So much so, I want to remind people that when I saw Home Alone 2 in the movie theaters, people forget there's a cameo by Donald Trump. Because he had so ingrained himself with this bullshit narrative that he was the kingmaker, even though he had multiple bankruptcies. But it doesn't matter. The story mattered. And people saw him and The Apprentice, where they literally had to make a studio and upgrade his shitty Trump towers and make the brass look golden. But that's the power of the story. And so I'm seeing the storytelling aspect of it right here, which still works. The grievance, make America great again. I still don't think Biden and Democrats have it. They fast forward to the end, and then two-thirds is wonk. People like AOC and Summer Lee, in my opinion, regardless of what you think about their politics, they inspire passion. They inspire like emotion. What should be the story then that Biden and Democratic establishment instill in America leading up to this pivotal election that I think we all agree can have a dramatic change for better or worse when it comes to this thing called democracy in America.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? Some people go for a run, some take a nap. I know that I do. But one of the most important things I think that you can do is spend an hour with and in therapy. I know that I do it once a week, and it is incredibly helpful and grounding and just makes me feel less alone.
And I also find it to be very helpful because you find a space to talk to someone. You're able to have a professional talk to you, listen to you, and it can help you be a better father, a better husband, a better citizen, a better neighbor. And my only regret, Danielle, was that I waited so long to actually talk to someone.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/democracy today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/democracy.
It sure can. You're absolutely right that Biden just fast forwards to the end. He says America's so great, and that's it. But he doesn't really give us this compelling story of how America, you know, became great and how we overcame all these obstacles, you know. And you really do need that story. Obama, as you suggest, embodied it himself. Trump, embodies his own bullshit story as well.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah,
but other, you know, people like Biden don't really embody the story themselves in their own lives to the same extent. Most politicians don't. I mean, everybody's got their own personal story, but let's face it, Biden's story is not as compelling as Obama's, or for that matter, as Trump's. I mean, one could argue, at least with people in Trump's electorate. So what we have to tell is a story of a country. Let's just pick race. Okay, which is a very important issue in the national story that the Democrats fumble all the time. So the Democrats don't seem to realize that whether we're talking about educating kids of the truth, telling them the truth about slavery and Jim Crow and our horrendous history of racial oppression in this country, or whether it comes to a whole host of other issues, including immigration, that we have vast majorities on our side. The Democrats act as if, you know, the Republican cramped ethno-national story has like 75% of Americans behind it. It does not. For my book, I studied the numbers on this. Vast majorities of Americans want to tell the truth about racism in schools. They want their kids to learn about racism in schools. They want their kids to, they do glory in our immigrant tradition. Americans are much more pro-immigrant now than any time in our history. We should be taking that to the bank. So we build those facts into our story. We acknowledge the fact that we have an advantage as voters on that.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Democrats tend to do right now, and this prevents them from telling a compelling national story that includes this crucial component of race and our overcoming racial oppression incompletely, still a woefully incompletely, but still we have made great strides. And instead, they just try to skirt the culture war issues because they think the Republicans have the advantage. And every time Biden or most Democrats are asked about things like critical race theory, they start talking about infrastructure spending. Like, their whole strategy is to divert attention from these issues, which, let's face it, most people vote on. Most people do not vote on prescription drug prices and infrastructure spending, to these so-called kitchen table issues. And they think that's a winner. It's not a winner. It makes them look like cowards, first of all. It prevents them from telling a truly compelling national story. And infrastructure spending is not going to be part of any compelling national story. So I have a part in the book where I talk about how the Democrats fall down on their faces on this. And I take critical race theory. Okay, so after Glenn Youngkin's election in Virginia, you might remember this is November 2021, the alarm bells went off for the Democrats because this is a deep blue state. And here you've got this Republican who came along and defeated a popular former Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe. And everybody wanted to know how he did this. Well, Youngkin talked in his campaign about giving more power over their kids' education to parents and, you know, not like dwelling on CRT, on critical race theory in the schools. He ends up winning. So after the election, journalists go to leading Democrats. They ask them, so what happened? How did this happen? And there was one particular press conference that was held the day after Youngkin won with Biden. It was at the White House. And a journalist asked Biden, he says, basically, look, the right is weaponizing critical race theory. What do you have to say about that? What is your line on critical race theory? Biden starts talking about infrastructure spending. Okay. So, and he goes on and on and on. And another reporter presses the case and says, no, but Mr. President, really, they're lying about critical race theory. They're lying about the Democrats thinking that the only history of America is this, you know, this long like parade of oppression. What do you have to say to that? He starts talking about prescription drug prices and the price of gasoline. All right. He won't answer the question. Now, and this goes on, there's a third and a fourth iteration. And finally, the journalists are just worn out. What does this show Biden to be? It shows him to be clueless about the fact that public opinion is on our side. And if you played this right, you could take it to the bank in elections. Number two, it makes him look like a coward. It makes him look, you know. So if you want to mobilize the base and actually inspire people who are not necessarily progressives, and people who are whites who are not necessarily, you know, are centrists or moderate right, who are definitely down with their kids knowing about the truth about what happened in our country's history, but are not necessarily progressives. If you want to win both of those groups, what Biden should have done, in my opinion, is say, look, CRT, what the hell is that? I think the Republicans made that up to divide our great nation. And if by critical race theory you mean, you know, that our country is this hall of injustice that can't improve itself and that racism is the only, you know, aspect of our country's history, we've never made any progress, I'll tell you that's a pile of shit. That's a bunch of nonsense. America is about becoming a more perfect union. You know, from the idiocy of Jim Crow to the brilliance of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, that is what America is all about, folks. And that's what we're doing under the Democrats. But if by CRT you mean we teach our kids the truth about our own nation's history, what patriot can be against that? How can any patriotic American be against teaching our kids the truth? This is what makes our country great. This is what makes us different from Russia or China, where all people ever learn about is how perfect their leaders and their country are. So if that's what you mean by critical race theory is teaching the truth about it, God damn it, put me down as a critical race theorist.
But what about the bridges?
Now, if Biden
spoke
that way, Trump couldn't get public attention for anything but his indictments. Biden can't even make news because he won't say these things. But the Democrats are so... And even when he talks about the bridges, rather than talk about the bridges that are being built, he says, oh, God, they're crumbling. Did you see that last bridge crumble?
Yep.
What about the bridges is exactly Biden's answer to these questions. But Democrats are so, and this is part of low dominance behavior, they're so risk averse, they're going through every line I just gave you and saying, oh, no, if he says that America's not a hall of injustice, he'll alienate the far left. And oh, no, if he says, put me down as a critical race theorist, Fox News just, say that over and over again.
That you're saying is just tell the truth. And with conviction.
Exactly. People will
not pay attention and own it and not pay attention to the polls.
And think about it. Yeah, absolutely.
I will say this, Steve. you brought us to school today on Democracy-ish, and I am just so honestly grateful for it, because dare I say this, Waj, I have a bit more hope today, which I don't often do.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
This was an undertaking. But folks, the book is out now. Come Back: Rooting Trumpism, Reclaiming the Nation, and Restoring Democracy's Edge. Steve, thank you so much for your time and for making the time for Democracy-ish. And I really do hope that you come back and join us again soon.
My pleasure, Danielle and Waj. It's been a pleasure to join your program. I'm a big fan of it, and it's so great to appear with you on it. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Amazing.
And I, for one, hope that Democrats actually listen to you. So that would be nice.
Yeah.
Because they don't listen to us.
That would be nice.
Really nice. This is kind of a memo to Democratic Party operatives. Yeah. And also, Danielle, I'm really flattered by the fact that you said that you feel more hopeful, because that is this book. This book really is trying to light a fire under our asses and also tell us, look, we can do this.
We can do it. And that's
among progressives these days is palpable. We can do this. This isn't rocket science.
No. Thank you for listening to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
And I'm Mujahat Ali.
And we will be back next week, if in fact we have a country left. Inshallah.